Hello there, Verbal Shenanigans fans, listeners. When was the last time you had a real challenge in your fantasy sports league? Are you bored with the stale and mundane redraft league year after year? DynastySportsEmpire.com understands, and that's why they are the nation's leading dynasty league management company. Building a team from scratch is easy, but building a dynasty takes skill. Manage your roster with the same players, compete against the same teams, build fun, exciting rivalries for years. DynastySportsEmpire.com fantasy baseball season is heating up and leagues are now forming for the upcoming season. Visit them online at DynastySportsEmpire.com to start building your future franchise today. Must be 18 years or older to join. Rules may apply, but that is DynastySportsEmpire.com. We have a fantastic episode for you today. I'm excited to bring it to you, so strap on in.
Hi, this is Leland Sklar, and you are listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Verbal Shenanigans, episode 340-something or other. Good to be back, Mike. I don't know, for some reason the beer is tasting better today. Yeah, the skies are bluer, and I am in a good mood. How are you?
I'm doing well. Got an early wake-up call for tomorrow. That'll be on the road for a little vacay. We don't have to discuss further.
Where are you going? You going to like a national park or an island or something?
A place of common targets, if you will.
Actually, it has all of them in it. Yeah. So welcome to the show. That's Mike. I'm Scott. We just got off earlier this afternoon. We recorded an episode with someone I've been trying to get on the show, and Mike's been trying to help me get on the show for, we calculated, close to 6 years. So it's like an accomplishment that was done. I don't want to give away too much info, but that should be out in 2 weeks. Okay, so but we got a great one today, so let's not downplay today. It's
no.
Me and you were just talking off air, if you will. Well, before I press the record button, I should say. I forgot that we both have spouses that have Valentine's Day and their birthday in the same week. Yours is the same day, correct?
It's the same day, and we started dating 2 days before her birthday. So, in essence, I have three things in 1 week.
Nice. So, you have like a... Well, do you celebrate, like, when you started dating, after you got married, do you still celebrate when you started dating?
I mean, we it still comes up, and we somewhat celebrate. It's not like, oh, this day we're going to do this or that because of it.
Yeah.
But it's still like, I do three cards every year, mostly.
Do you remember the cards, or you just give her last year's that you forgot?
We'll take option two for this year.
Really?
Hand to God, yeah. Like if you're kind of new to the podcast, I have a history of buying cards for birthdays, anniversaries, Father's Day, Mother's Day, and I have a knack of getting them, but not actually sending them to the person in time.
What would you say, honestly, is the total amount of cards you have at the moment of all unsent cards?
Well, like when we were cleaning up, when I moved down from Jersey to Georgia, I suspect I had four cards from my dad and three or four cards from my mom of different occasions, birthday, Father's Day, Mother's Day. I would say somewhere in that ballpark around 8.
Nice. It'd be funny if like we were able to flip the perspective like in a TV show and your mom and dad are just like having conversations on that. Like all he had to do was send me a card. Like he just doesn't care. It's 4 years in a row he hasn't sent me a card.
Yeah, it was pretty bad like that. Like every year I would call him like, I got your card. I'll get it to you. And then, like, the next year, I'm like, I know what I said last year, and I got you a card for this year. But
cards, like, I just was shopping for card yesterday. Cards have gotten ridiculously expensive. I'm like,
ooh, yeah.
I'm like, are you kidding me? Like Christmas cards, I'm like, oh, I'll get one for my mom. I'll get one for the wife. And then sometimes I was like, yeah, maybe I'll get one for my sister this year. And I'm like, $6.99 a piece. Like, it's just absurd. And it's like, there's no sales on them. It's the price is like the price on the back of the card. It's pretty absurd.
Yeah, and for the most part, like when I get a card, I literally write out like a statement in them. So it's like I just need
happy. So next good, year,
but I don't want like the uber generic and all happy birthday. Thanks for being
now,
here.
Now, the cards, you know what I mean? The cards that you forgot to send, are they written out? Like, is it like, Happy Father's Day, 2014?
No. Again, it's like, I bought the card. I'm like, all right, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to make sure a week before, I'm going to write whatever and sign it out. Maybe get my dad a gift card, something like that. And then I get it, as you know, like my last job was just murder on me for like time and attitude, whatever. It was always be the same thing. It'd be like, I'd be scrolling through my Facebook. It's your father's birthday. I'm like, son of a.
Now, do you have to celebrate like mine? They're separated by 4 days, the 10th and the 14th. So I got to do something and then a little something on the Valentine's Day. Do you have to celebrate them separately somehow on the day? Like, here's your Valentine's Day gift, here's your birthday gift, or is it just like, or did you get a pass? Like, are you able to just, hey, I knocked out two in one?
Well, I don't do a gift for the dating anniversary. Right. But for the wedding anniversary, I'll get her something, obviously. But it's pretty much, since we travel anyway, I make sure I get her something, like, kind of decent, but it's like, it's all in one for like the moment. I mean, like I said, we're pretty much, I think the last 4 years on her birthday, which is pretty much also with the dating anniversary, we have been somewhere. Hasn't always been that certain place.
Yeah, one time.
If I recall, yeah, before we moved down here, we were in Boston for that weekend, so.
Wow. We call those the golden days, you know, the days where you're allowed to see. You're kind of like a prisoner almost, like you're not allowed to see outside the rest of the world. You know, it's like,
yeah, it's like a weird deal. If you were like part time home arrest, part time jail, where it's like, oh, it's that time of year. Get down to the precinct.
It's like it's the best jail ever, but it's still jail. Like, you know what I mean? It's like. It's like everybody would get sick of anything at some point. You're like on the Truman Show, you know? Like,
yeah, I just want to whisper, listen, I know what's going on. Can we just get some new characters in and just spice up today for a bit?
Guys, I haven't seen Mr. Incredible in 4 straight trips. Like, what's going on here? I wonder how they do that. I wonder how they, like, vary the characters you'll see. Or, like, does the same person play the same character, or is it like, hey, Mike, you're Donald today, and then tomorrow you just slap on the Goofy costume and you're in the same spot? Or, hey, you're Donald, like, that's you, Mike, and you go,
that's
hey,
your career.
You're there, then next day you're at the Epcot, the next day you're at here. Like, they must coordinate so, like, two Donalds don't run into each other.
Well, they would pretty much put, like, one in each park. Like, there would be, you know, Mickey and all 4 their theme parks, a Donald in each one. It would be a different costume or whatever for each one.
Yeah.
But I would assume that, like, a person could go from park to park as Donald, but they probably keep him as the same character, because I'm sure there's got to There's got to be some, like, booklet. It's like, this is a Donald. This is a Goofy.
Yeah, there had to be some slip-ups over the years where two Donalds walk out at the same time. Like, oh, crap, Scott, you were supposed to be, you know, Goofy today. Oh, no. And
kids what are you doing in Hollywood Studios? What? You're supposed to be Magic Kingdom. No!
And the kid's just like, there's two Donalds! And just mayhem.
Like some 6-year-old's mind is just like totally blown. It's just, how could it be too goofy? Is it like the Spider-Verse?
It'd be fun if like there was like a hierarchy in the locker room. Like, I don't know, maybe Mickey's like the number one, and like there's like fights over who, like almost like sparring matches in the locker room, and whoever's the toughest guy able to keep that championship and pick the character he wants.
So you think it's kind of like kind of like UFC or something like that, where the veteran gets the like extra choices in what he does and so forth. And
right, yeah, like
I've been here for 13 years. I'm not going down to Chippendale. Okay,
exactly. Like the characters that get further and further away from like kids knowing who they are. Like Chippendale, they got to be a borderline of kids. Like who's those rodents? You know, like where you know someone like. Moana or something, you're pretty popular right now.
Well, the quote princesses, they're all like a girl dressed up in the outfit, so that's a little, I think that's a little different than going into the costume.
Just wait to woke culture ruins that, and some guys like I'm Moana.
Really, Rock? Yeah, I was in the movie. I told them they cast me in the wrong.
I am Belle now. Hi, kids. And be like, it's 20. It's 2028. This is what it is now. Disney's a free for all. I mean, we're already seeing it, like with sports and things like that. I don't know. Disney might be next.
Well, they somewhat did. Like they have something for kids where it's like Princess I think it's called the Princess Boutique, where like girls would go in and, you know, get makeuped up and dressed up as whatever princess they want. And I think it was like, I want to guess 4 or 5 years ago, like a boy asked to do it. And at first they're like, well, no, this is a service for girls.
Right.
And then it got to a little bit of a story. And then they said, okay. Boys want to be a princess. Princess.
That's totally fine to me. Yeah. I'm just thinking about some like
the actual character,
a Brock Lesnar-y looking guy walking around in a bell costume and ruining the ruining the illusion.
Disney, at least everything I've seen, I won't be surprised down the road have a character like that to break that barrier.
Yeah,
not okay. A guy can be Moana, but they'll have some kind of story where it's like, because they're kind of good. Like, there's always been a rumor that the one from Frozen, I forget her name, Anna, is supposedly a lesbian.
Okay.
Like, there was rumors they were gonna, they kind of toyed with it in the movie, but they didn't go like full force. So yeah. I can totally see them like going, okay, you know, we press this, you know, why not?
Yeah, actually, today, woke, I guess, PC culture got rid of a Disney. You had Gina Carano's Dunzo in The Mandalorian there. Some, I guess, off-colored tweets, some things about the Holocaust and living in the pandemic is like that. And some...
Yeah, I had the thing she put up on the story. It was like, you know, it was something in effect of the Nazi soldiers were not the ones that found out Jewish people. It was their neighbors who found out they were Jewish and called them out and beat them up and stuff like that. And then the last thing was something like it equates to today's politics and what.
It's just like if you're on that Disney corporation or any one of these big ABCs, NBC, you know, like, you know, you're you are silenced, and so you can't be doing like that's just the way where we are now. You know, as soon as you bring up the Holocaust in a tweet, you're running a fine line as far as the corporate world.
If you're going to bring up like Holocaust and Nazis, you better be the most articulate, beautiful writer on earth. Because if you don't get 100 on that statement you put out there, you are gonzo. There is, there's no way to slip out the, you know what I mean? Nazis.
It's just better off to, like, I think when you're at that point, when you're on a super successful thing, it's better off like having someone run your Twitter. It's better off to just step away until that part goes away, and then you want to like, then you could be like, I don't know, after you're done, after you made your money and you made your success, if you want to voice your, I don't know, wild opinions, then do it. But you know, if you really care about that job, you know, it's just anything you say now, it's just, it can be used in any way. And I know she got a lot of heat for like some right wing things, which I don't feel is, you know, she can get the heat, but she should be allowed to take it too. I think, like, if she's going to put it out there, but you know, like she crossed that line. That's
to a degree. Like, I've been thinking lately, in a way, I do feel bad for like regular, not over the top conservatives. Not in the sense like, oh, you can't have like crazy views or anything like that, but in the sense, you can't, nowadays you can't even just say, hey, you know, I'm a conservative or whatever. And I do feel bad for them in that sense. And we have to get past what just occurred and kind of say, people have a right to kind of say, you know, I want less taxes. I don't think the government could be big and stuff
We've also equated now, like, even the word conservative now has just turned into like a, especially by, you know, completely democratically run big social media platforms. It's just turned into like, that's like the wearing the scarlet letter now. Like, that word is like a no. You'll see over the next, as they prepare for the next election cycle, God willing, it's, you know, they get past this whole Trump thing and just, you know, come up with someone maybe a little bit more representable and a little bit more control, but they'll come up with like almost like a new term. There's going to be a think tank out there where they're like, you know, the word conservative is stained right now so bad that like they're going to come up with like a new term for a modern Republican. It's going to be something out there.
Yeah, like a moderate or something to that effect, or it's kind of like, all right, that's not bad, that's catchy.
Yeah, somewhat, like where, you know, like where they could shed the you know, the biases or whatever that come along with that word. I mean, it happens the same way. Like when people talk about, they use the word liberal. So like that word doesn't mean liberal anymore. Like the actual, you know, it means like everything outside of it. It means like people are offended by everything and tell you what it's almost done a 180. Like if you were to look up the definition of liberal, it doesn't mean anything what like the people who use it as a, I don't know, a slur or whatever, as a, hey, you lib, like, they mean, they're trying to say you cry about everything, you censor everything, which is so funny because the word is liberal, which is, you know, free and open. And, but, you know.
They basically say, and they think of a 1960s hippie. It's just the most awkward thing, you know. I don't know. I mean, I would say get a third party, not the Trump party, but a third party in there.
Yeah. I wanted to segue in. We were talking about, I don't know, the prison, saying your life is like a fun prison. I have a little movie recommendation, and I wanted to go over it. There's a movie called The Last Stop. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a documentary. Now, I just pummel my head with documentary. I'm such, like, when you have a baby, like, I've been watching more, like you watch a lot of stuff because there's not, you know, the TV's on, you're kind of holding the baby or taking care of the baby. You're not really going anywhere. Even in the rest of your, I'm not going in the garage to work on things. I'm kind of taking care of the baby. So you try to watch things. Like, I've been watching that movie Vice with Christian Bale as Dick Cheney. It's fantastic.
Oh, okay. I saw that movie. That was really good. Fantastic. Theaters.
And I think Christian Bale has taken over my top actor spot. Everything that guy's in is like, he just commits so much, and he puts out a lot, which I like. Like, my favorite actor for a long time is Edward Norton, and honestly, I haven't liked much. Haven't liked much of what he's put out in recent years, and he doesn't do a lot. So there'll be like 3-4 years between projects, and they're like, ah, like I saw his last one, Motherless Brooklyn, and it was a good attempt, but I just like couldn't get into it. Just slow. Mm-hmm. You know, like
That's the thing with some of these actors. They get these visions of, I need to give the full story and the full range of what this character did and whatever. And then you turn to him, it's like, Edward, you're the Hulk. You get mad, you turn into a CGI beast, and you smash things.
Yeah, yeah.
No, but I want to think back. How did his mother affect him becoming the Hulk? She did not hit him with radiation, so nothing at all, Edward. We did.
I mean, when he was on that run in the, I don't know, was that late 90s, I guess? Whatever, like American History X to Fight Club to...
People versus Larry Flint. He was
The Score. He was just in a whole bunch of great movies. He like blew me away with his Death to Smoochie. I even liked. Like there was
that's a great one. Underrated.
Like I just think he was in them. No, it's an underrated one. The one with him and Ben Stiller, where they're a priest and a rabbi. That is a good movie. From what I remember, anyway. I haven't seen it in years, but that was a cool movie. But anyway, so yeah, Christian Bale is like, I just think that guy is so damn good. I think it's like Keeping the Faith or something like that. But anyway, Christian Bale's so damn good. And it's pretty cool. Like now I'm like excited to see him in a Marvel movie. He's going to be the bad guy in the Thor or something like that. I'm like, he's going to kill that role. Like the guy is, and everything is so different. But I think he just puts out more. And I kind of like that. Anyway.
Yeah, he didn't fall into the fate of Edward Norton. I mean, he's kind of started that route where he was... hard to work with and fighting with people and stuff like that. It seems like he kind of calmed it down where it's like, I love my art and I want to keep on getting these things. And I think that's what killed Norton because he basically got blackballed from the major stuff where it's like, you get like 25 things. You're like, ooh, that 23rd thing. I never thought of that.
I think he could really act. He's too pretentious in a way. Like even the Motherless Brooklyn movie, I was like, it's good. I get what he's going for. The super... interesting character with Tourette and whatnot, but like it's like the rest of the movie's got to be good too. It can't just be like this one character that was good and the rest of it's kind of like blah and boring and slow. Like the last thing I kind of liked from him was like Birdman, I think was the last thing I really kind of dug.
I forgot about that. That was an excellent movie too, Michael Keaton.
Yeah, but Bale's kind of like I feel like he always delivers, which I kind of respect about him. And he's like one movie he's Dick Cheney and he's all overweight. The next movie is 100 pounds and like he's just done a lot of cool stuff. Anyway, that's kind of getting off topic there. But there's this movie called The Last Stop, and it's a documentary about this. Housing for a camp / housing for troubled children in, I think it went from like the 80s to like 2010, it got shut down. It was called Elan, ELAN, and it was in Maine. So essentially, these kids, it started off as kids who had like drug problems and behavior problems, and they were sent to Elan. And like from the beginning, it was kind of like, I mean, they're showing some of the kids doing... they're not kids anymore. They're full-grown adults doing the interviews. And you're like, oh, man. These are definitely some off people. Like, And they're explaining. And they're kind of selling it as, like, it's this center for people who... You know, kind of like a rehab facility. But they're like, it's a no-nonsense rehab facility. Once you sign up, you can't leave. You have to do your time. You're not allowed to leave. We will come find you. I'm like, okay. So you start to watch the movie a little bit more, and I'm not really ruining anything. It's a documentary, so it's just really... But you watch it more, and the place was essentially like this guy's vision of just like punishing kids. Like people would stand in the front with like dunce caps on, and the other 100 people in the camp would come and scream in your face. He would have kids, if they misbehaved, which I'll get to that in a second, they have to sit in a corner of a room like you would if you were a kid. Like, remember, we weren't a kid. Go sit in the corner. But for, like, 3 days, 4 days, 3 weeks, 6 months, kid to sit in the corner. And then he encouraged... He had different roles in the rehab. We'll just call it the rehab facility, I guess. So, like, Mike, if you were there for a little while, you would be, like, a... I don't remember the names they used. You were a counselor now. So you were in charge of the underlings under you, and you were encouraged to rat people out for doing things. Then all the phones were tapped. All the mail was read by the actual people who attended the play. So they started this like society of people who would just rat on each other and tell on each other. Then like, so you're like, okay, this is really messed up, okay? And then, so the documentary starts to go on, and the guy started essentially just getting greedy, and like there was no restrictions back then. So it wasn't just troubled kids anymore. It was sexual abuse survivors, kids who murdered someone. It was parents who just couldn't deal with their kids would send them there. It started expanding to anything you could possibly like think of that could get you under this roof, and he would have, and he had hundreds of kids, and they had these ceremonies where they would just tell you how awful you were and how terrible you were, and then paddle you with ping pong paddles. And like they were describing one, this girl was paddled so hard she had like open blisters on her like ass for like days. And then they start to unveil more, and they had a ring. They had a boxing ring where they would surround you with other people, and they'd tell you how awful you are. And if you beat one guy, they'd send another kid in to be, and then they'd send another kid. So it was like this gladiator approach to like rehab, and it just kept flying under the radar in Maine. Like, and they would have like inspectors, like health inspectors and whatever, you know, they'd come and hear that this was an abusive place, and but they would always tell them they were coming. So every time they would come, they would clean up their act, you know, and it took until like investigators from like New York State were able to go, and they went unannounced and they started revealing it. And the only reason this thing kind of blew up was like a survivor or a kid who went to it put it up on Reddit, like his experience, and it just like blew up where all of a sudden like everybody else was chiming in on their experience. Dude, what a wild documentary. That's all I have to say. It's just crazy.
That is absolutely insane. Like, first off, all I can think of is like if kids get like scared of like presenting in front of a class, and I could just fathom what they went through when they're having a whole assembly just to say, okay, oh, Michael, come on up here, and I'll, here's 300 reasons why you're an idiot.
And yeah, they said like even good kids, like they would just find reasons for you to have a like a penalty or whatever they call it. They'd be like, Mike picked up a pencil. He didn't ask if he was allowed to pick up the pencil. He needs to have, and they called them general meetings, and they'd be like, general meeting, and everyone would rush in and have like a general meeting about you, Mike, and just tell you you're a piece of crap, you're awful, you're terrible, and come so close to you and scream in your face for like hours on end. It was like, it felt like some like terrible horror movie that someone wrote, because it was like, and then like of course they, you know, they do the, you get to the end of the movie and they talk about like, you know, how it got shut down and whatnot, and then like you, of course, you're going to hear from the people afterwards. It's like, this person went on to be a stripper with a heroin habit. This person was fine until he was like 32 and then realized he couldn't leave the house anymore because he was just like anxiety ridden and started like a 25 bag a day heroin thing. They were like, this person overdosed. One of the, something with the Kennedys got the attention because one of their relatives or something like that went there because he murdered someone. But it's just like, this person died of an overdose, this person became a drug dealer, this person lived in the woods. It was just like crazy. Yeah, so it's like, it's just like mind-blowing documentary. It's just like everything before the internet it was just chaos. I feel like if we could write a history book like of all the things that happened pre-internet, because nobody knows anything. Imagine, can you imagine me being like, okay, Mike, Shay's been really, you know, I can't handle him. Say we're doing this 10 years from now, and these are like 13-year-old kids, and they would stay for like 4 years straight. So imagine I'm talking to you on the podcast here. I'm like, you know, we're really thinking about sending him to this school in Maine. You know, they say they correct kids' behavior, and you know, and I really feel like by the time they return him to us at 18, he's going to be a good citizen. Like, what would you, what are the people around these parents saying? Is what I, you know?
Well, like for starters, I'd probably be jealous because I'd be probably end the podcast and be like, damn, Scott's got send the kid to Maine kind of money, man. What the hell am I doing? Is he in the stock market or something?
That's damn, the other thing. Back then, it was like for a full year, it was close to $56,000 a year.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Who has 56K spare and know what the hell these people are going to do to the kid?
That's what I'm saying. It's like I think it's just people who don't want to deal with their kids. Just lazy parents. Like, the documentary focuses so hard on... Like, if there was a part two, I would love to hear interviews with... Now, a lot of them might be dead by now. But I would love to hear from the parents what they were thinking. Like, oh, I was my Mike was doing so many drugs, we couldn't handle him anymore. So we just figured we'd ship him off and let someone else take care of him. Like, I get the rehab facilities. I'm very close with somebody I know that had a drug problem, and the rehab really worked for him, and he's had a slip up or two, but like that was like a 90-day program, focused on one thing with proven results, and he had the ability to leave. That's the other thing, Mike. They would come, like, say your parents enrolled you, they'd come in the middle of the night with four other kids and grab you and throw you in a truck and drive you to Maine.
Wow. like that's your introduction.
Yeah.
And technically you can say that was probably the best day of my life, but considering everything that they do right there.
Dude, it's such a bizarre documentary. It's like, I love finding these little, I mean, there's so many good documentaries, but this one was like, It just makes you it makes me think like how much other atrocious stuff has happened before there was any records and digital, like people able to speak out. Like, these are all kids who were troubled to begin with, who were poor, who were sexually abused, who were everything, that didn't have a voice at all. You know, clearly they didn't have a voice to their parents to do anything. So they're just like alone and trapped, and it's a really like really scary reality. Like, you're like, yeah, okay, the internet can be good for some things. You know, like, Jesus Christ. Like, these, like, because now if I'm going to send my son to a, maybe he needs to go to a therapist one day, I can go online and read every review of this therapist and get information. And like, before that, it must have been just a shot in the dark. Like, okay, yeah, I trust you. You're pretty good.
It was pretty much, well, he's got a doctor in his name, so he must know what he's doing.
And the guy who was running these things ran for governor of Maine.
Oh, not surprised. Yeah. Not like, as you were telling the story, like, it almost fathomed, like, he went on to be like a trainer at like the, like an Amazon or a Walmart, someplace where you only make $7 an hour, but you're crapping your pants to lose that job kind of deal.
Yeah.
Cause I feel like he would have been superior and you ain't going nowhere.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I would recommend, I could talk about it forever, but it's almost like I want you to go see it and then like have your reaction. Cause it was, I think it's on Amazon Prime if you have Prime, but wow, it was pretty mind blowing. I think it's only like 3 years old too. So,
so you feel like it'll be like Siskel and Ebert where you're like, oh my God, this guy is terrible. And I'll come around. Well, I don't know, Scott. I mean, the way I look at the film was he was battling these troubled teens head on. I mean, he was thinking outside the box. Most people are trying to box with their inner demons. He sent them in a boxing ring against the entire school.
They would make you hang signs around your neck and be like, I am worthless. I ruin every holiday for my family. I wear them for a week. One girl, I forget what, I think she got pregnant or something early on or whatever. They made her wear a crown of tampons around her head. Like, it is the most bizarre, offensive, like, you just can't believe things like this exist. So, go check out The Last Stop. And if you do, tell us what you think. Send us a message on Instagram or whatnot, because it was brutal.
Or see a cheerful movie and tell us about it, because that, you're just going to bring us down by telling us what you thought of The Last Stop.
So let's, I don't know how we segue out of that, but we have a really cool, guest.
Speaking of torture.
We have a really cool guest on the coming up in just a second here. So if you're just listening to the show, we always kind of talk about life and whatnot. We always bring on a really interesting guest, or what we feel is like a really interesting guest. And today's is great. So if you're into music, we've had some amazing bass players on the show, like Victor Wooten and Stu Cook of Creedence Clearwater. And today we have another legendary bass player. Now, he's played with James Taylor, Toto, Phil Collins, Jackson Browne, Carole King, just to name a few. He has been in the music industry essentially for 50 years now, maybe even a little bit more. and he has just an epic beard, which makes him even cooler. But he's an amazing session musician, has amazing stories, does some really cool stuff, and he was a really great interview. So we're going to bring on Leland Sklar onto the show. So here is our interview with Leland. Leland, how are you doing?
I am completely adequate.
Well, I guess that's a good answer nowadays. I mean, it pretty much sums up how we're all feeling these days.
Yes.
Most.
Just striving for it at this point. It's
that's awesome.
Tough time.
Leland, I'm Scott. That's Mike. Thanks for giving us a few minutes on the show here. I appreciate your time.
No, it's an absolute pleasure.
I guess we're going to get into your music career one up, but I guess as a fellow bearded man, yeah. when was the last time you were clean shaven in your life?
When they handed me my high school diploma in 1965.
Wow. Wow.
It was an incredibly repressive period. And we had grooming guards and stuff in school then, and they would bust your chops if your hair could go over your ear and things like that. So I kind of said, fuck you. The minute I got I trim it. I've cut it a lot. I mean, I've never been clean shaven, but I trim it all the time just to, because it's always caught in my strap locks when I'm playing.
Oh, yeah.
Works as a mute.
It's gorgeous is what I'm saying. I'm a little
Where
jealous.
Are you guys located?
What'd you say?
Where are you guys located?
So I'm in New Jersey. Mike's in Georgia. Where are we calling you at today?
I'm in Pasadena.
Okay.
In LA.
I got to say, for a second, I thought you had a guy behind you just sitting patiently, just watching. I was going to say, you could bring him in on the interview if you want. No problem. For those listening, Leland has like a dummy of some sort.
Some sorts.
Oh, sorry.
A mannequin with a hat and a mask on that is way realistic looking. What's going on with the mannequin?
It's as close to management as I'm ever going to get. So I've got a whole bunch of these. I've got a couple of them looking out windows of the house just to make the place look occupied. They're called safety men. You know, women would buy them to put in the car with them in case they were driving around alone. And sometimes I carry one in my truck in case I have to go to a session during rush hour. I can use the carpool lane and hope I don't get pulled over.
Leland, I could tell I'm going to really enjoy speaking to you over the next 30 minutes.
The mask is from the Wrecking Crew movie.
Oh, okay.
Danny Tedesco gave me the mask. So,
huh.
Oh, nice.
Little promo.
Nice. Go ahead, Mike.
So, Lee, when you were a little younger, like as I'm reading up on you, you were like a really good piano player, but your teacher kind of swayed you away from guitar. It's usually the other way where kids are like, I want to play guitar. And they're like, no, that's not going to get you anywhere. And they learn the classics and all. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Well, I started studying classical piano when I was 5 years old. My parents used to watch the Liberace TV show, and I kind of fell in love with the whole idea of piano. And we had a baby grand piano in the house, even though nobody was really a major player. It was a family heirloom kind of thing. And I actually got very good at it very quickly. I ended up, by the time I was 8 years old, I won some won awards from the Hollywood Bowl Association as like one of the most accomplished young pianists, you know, and that kind of
really?
Thing, you know. It's but when I got into junior high school, I assumed I would be, you know, the piano player in the orchestra. It was, you know, it just felt like a natural thing. And the music teacher said, look, we got like 50 kids that play piano. We need a string bass player.
Huh.
And he pulled out an old K upright, this beautiful blonde old K bass, and put it in my hands. And I held it and plucked one note, felt that vibration run through me. And I said, I'll go for it. And I left piano at that point and just focused strictly studying bass and started. It was mostly classical and jazz for me. I really didn't get into rock and roll until really the Beatles hit. That kind of changed my... Like so many other players I know, that was a real pivotal time in Ireland, the English invasion took place and all those groups, because I wasn't like into Elvis or the Beach Boys or a lot of things that were going on during that period. But it changed my life dramatically as soon as those guys hit. And my dad took me in and I got an electric bass, which was the next quantum change in my life, going from upright to electric. And I've just been grinding this path ever since. It's been a good run.
It's amazing because I the bass player too, and not too much anymore. But it always seems like bass finds someone in a unexpected way. Like it always is like, hey, we started this garage band, we have five guitar, you know, everyone wants to be the guitarist and drummer, and it's like someone's got to play the bass, and people fall in love with it. Or it's interesting to hear in your case, you were asked to pick up the upright bass.
I never played guitar in my life, so for me it was piano then to bass. Where, like you're saying, so many times somebody would be the bass player by default in a group. They needed a bass player, and then maybe like the lamest guitar player in the band to be the guy that they would,
correct,
really to be the bass player.
Yeah, someone had a bass in their garage that was collecting dust. It's like you could pick that, you know. But we've had so many awesome bass players here on the show. I mean, the one that comes to mind is Victor Wooten. We had him on twice. One of my favorite guys to talk to. Like, amazing. I remember growing up playing bass in these bands and seeing his videos and just being like, well, I'm going to go burn this thing right
Why
now.
Why bother?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Vic, beyond the fact that he's probably one of the most gifted bass players in the world, he's also one of the most soulful cats I've ever known. He's a very dear friend, and man, I could sit and listen to him for hours. He's his outlook on life and everything, the whole Wooten family, is remarkable.
And such a generous guy. Like, he gave us, you know, it was this, you know, some people we email, some people will reach out to their agents. Like, I reached out to him on Facebook, and he... So absolutely, do an interview, and then he did another one.
Great,
you know, a year later. So, but it's cool to see like the bass players who are just so passionate about it. And I think when you become, you know, great at it, you become such a wanted person in a band. And I think that kind of speaks to you. You know, you're hard to even look up all the things you've done, because it's just album after album. You know. Amazing musician after amazing musician that you've worked for. I guess my first question is, as you got better at the bass and your first learning, what was kind of like your first, I don't like to call it a break, but your first kind of like step into the professional world of playing music?
Well, I mean, it was absolutely when I hooked up with James Taylor, when James was just beginning, and I was in... Excuse me, I just dropped some headphones here. I've been doing overdubs just before we called. I'm
nice.
Working on an album project for somebody. So I was in a band in the late 60s called Wolfgang. And our drummer had a friend named John Fishbeck. And John owned Crystal Recording Studios here in Hollywood. Now, I had never been in a recording studio except to cut a demo with this band I was in. And John came, he would hang out at our rehearsals, and he had done Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life, engineered that, and all the early Stevie Wonder stuff. He's an amazing guy. And that's actually who I was just working with. I mean, all these years later, we still work together. But he brought a friend of his who had just gotten back from England to our rehearsal, and it was James. And then James, his record came out, and he got offered a gig at the Troubadour here in Los Angeles. Right. And... They had a band, but they didn't have a bass player. And he remembered me from a rehearsal, and they tracked me down, and I went and played one gig with him, thinking that was all I was going to do because I was still in college at that point. And I thought I'd play one gig and that would be fine. And it turned in that one gig turned into the rest of my life. So you just don't know.
No,
you come to these forks in the road, and if it hadn't been James, I might not have had this career, because James was like the perfect storm for that period in 1970, where there was about to be a really quantum change, certainly in West Coast music, with the advent of that pop kind of mellow but rock and singer-songwriter movement and all that. And I was lucky to be right in the middle of it when it went down.
It's awesome.
When you're starting this kind of career, I mean, what's your initial thoughts on what your vision was? Were you thinking, like most people do, it's just like, I'm going to get into a big band, we're going to have number one hits and just keep going on and on? Or were you just thinking, go with the flow and just see who needs a bass player? What was your kind of mindset through the years?
We kind of jumped like right into the fire when all of this went down. I mean, having had no real studio experience, and within a real short period of time, being a first call studio bass player was, you know, kind of learn while you earn. You're just trying to figure out how to negotiate through life in the studio. I would have always, you know, ultimately it would have been great to have been in a band that was successful and had that to do with my life. But I think, like with the other guys, that with Russ Kunkel and Danny Korchmar, all the guys that I started with, we were just happy to have a gig. Mm-hmm. You know, and we were mm-hmm. all coming from not working at all to having more work than we could possibly handle. And so we just, we just kind of embraced the moment on it. I really never saw that it was going to be a career in the beginning. I was just really thrilled to be working and playing and doing what I was doing. You know, at the end of the day, I think everybody would love to be in a band that's successful, but I don't think I would change anything, because I've been really fortunate to work with so many people over all these decades that I feel a wealth that I've accumulated in more in relationships than in monetary aspect of it. Yeah, I feel really fortunate. You know, I've worked really hard, and I really appreciate every day that we get to work.
Yeah. So, like, people who may not know Leland, like, you know, you mentioned James Taylor, but you've also worked with Jackson Browne and Phil Collins and Carole King and Toto and band after band. So it's interesting you say that, how you keep, you know, maybe you didn't have the one successful band, but you've played with some of the, you know, some of the artists that are going to be literally long after me, you, and our kids are gone, they're going to be turning on these songs and, you know, hearing your work. You know, we had Stu Cook on the podcast from Creedence.
Oh, great.
Awesome guy. And, you know, he was, you know, his band, they had awful turmoil, obviously, as we know, and, you know, Creedence kind of, and he was talking about, like, that difficulty of trying to reinvent yourself and find another footing after doing something like that. You kind of seem like you've had the opposite. You've been able to fit in and reinvent yourself a bazillion times. So I guess my question is, how do you, like, I don't know what you're into personally. You might be into every kind of music, but like all those artists we just named, they're all very, very different. Do they hire you just knowing that you're the guy that can do anything, or were you able to kind of pick those projects too?
Well, I think there's an element of that in there, because I've kind of embraced like all genres.
Yeah.
So like I can be working, you know, like when I did Spectrum with Billy Cobham, and then I've done hip hop and I've done country and all. Most people that hire me just, I guess... In the beginning, we got hired a lot, but we didn't have a history because we were still all starting up, and people would listen to like James and they really liked what they heard on his records. I think one of the real fortunate things that happened in my life was Peter Asher, who was producing James and managing him. When we started working, previous to that, very few musicians ever got credit on albums. So like when the Wrecking Crew existed, nobody knew that it was the same guys playing on Sinatra and the Mamas and the Papas and all these different artists. These guys were just working musicians. But when our names appeared on the albums, then when other artists were getting signed, they would look at maybe James as like a benchmark of what they wanted to do. And they would look on the back of that record and they'd see me and Russ Kunkel and Danny Korchmar and all of us. And they would say, look, if it works for James, let's hire those guys. I mean, I'm assuming that's probably really how things got going initially.
Right.
But then as your career goes on, then you develop a reputation for consistency and for whatever the taste is that people are looking for. And your work ethic you know, people get to know you on a multiple levels through producers, engineers, different artists, you know, word of mouth. So, but it's a constantly evolving situation in a career.
Yeah.
So,
is it more exciting when you're getting to play with some kind of big name that you heard of? You're like, oh my God, they're a star. Or is it more exciting when you don't know the band that's requesting you, where you can kind of like kind of put your skills into another place, if you will?
Probably, you know, I would say probably both. You know, when I go in the studio, like if I was in the studio and I'm working with like Joe Cocker, you know, and I walk in and I see Joe, man, I'm still pinching myself because I'm still fanboy.
Right.
You know, so, you know, I would be freaking out a little bit over, you know, Ray Charles or Streisand or any of those people. But I really love when I go in the studio and it's an unknown artist, a new artist, and they blow me away. And you can be there for the kind of the launch of their career. And it's really exciting because certainly with a big, a major act, a major star, you kind of know what you're getting into. But when you walk in the room and you have no clue who the person is in there and they sit down and start playing and you take your breath away, that's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
To me.
So we've had, we've had so many awesome people on, a lot of musicians on during this pandemic and whatnot. And, you know, a lot of them are full-time touring bands and guys who had tours canceled and whatnot. And, you know, we've been kind of asking every artist, like, how have they, you know, used this time to kind of stay creative? Has it been a complete bust for them or has it inspired them? Like, I'm interested in your perspective because you do so much session work and whatnot and probably recording whatnot. How have you, like, handled this pandemic time as an artist?
It started off kind of horrifying, like what everybody's gone through, where I was, you know, looking at a year's worth of work that blew away like a fart in a windstorm. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like just suddenly gone.
Yeah.
Because I had a lot of work overseas, so there was a lot of touring involved. But I kind of sat and I thought, what the hell am I going to do? The last real gig we played, I'm in a group called The Immediate Family, which is the guys I started with back in 1970.
Wow.
With Russ Kunkel and Danny Porchmore and Waddy Wachtel. And we did a gig at the end of February, this Rock Legends cruise that was from Fort Lauderdale to Cayman Islands and back. And that was the last time we played anything live, because right after that is when the pandemic hit. I had come off of, just before that, I'd come off of a Phil Collins tour. We were out for a couple of years doing a tour called Not Dead Yet. And I had some people, bass players, writing to me saying they had seen the shows, and we did a lot of stadiums on that. And they said we had seen the shows, and we could, you know, hear really well, but still there were some details in your stuff that we, you know, we weren't quite sure about. And I decided to, I had our front of house guy, Michelle Collan, sent me one of our shows from Australia. And I just put it in my computer and plugged in a little Bose speaker, and I have a bass amp next to me. And I filmed myself playing the songs from the show, but playing it so that the bass part was sitting on top of the track rather than in the track.
Right.
And I started with the first song of the show. And by the third day, when I was on the third song, people started writing, going, man, we love your YouTube channel. Hmm. And I'm going, what are you talking about? And they said, you know, that YouTube channel you started. I said, I have no idea what they were talking about. I was just trying to show some people some bass parts. And this is, during the pandemic, has totally been a major consuming factor for me. I've got about 430 videos up now. I've done one every single day since March. Huh. And I don't know, I got about 146,000 people on the channel now.
Good
and,
for
and,
you.
And like today I was doing an album I did with Roger McGuinn from the Byrds. And yesterday I did Trisha Yearwood. And I'm going through all these records and talking about the sessions and the players. And on a lot of the stuff I'm playing along. So that has been really fabulous to focus and have this kind of a thing to do. And I formed a clubhouse within that network, and I do a couple of live streams a month with all the people that come on and do that. And then I did a book while during this period that people have been bugging me to do for years, but it's not about me. It's 6,000 pictures of people giving me the finger. And it's a huge 6-pound coffee table book that's really getting really a great response. And, you know, I mean, I just looked at this time as how can I best fulfill this time when I really can't go out and do anything.
Right.
I'm recording at home for the first time in my career. I never had a home setup, and now I've got people contacting me about doing parts. So I got myself an interface, and I'm plugged into GarageBand, and I'm doing a project with Ian Pace right now from Deep Purple.
Deep Purple,
and,
yeah.
You know, all kinds of crap. So I'm actually busier than I would have been had this not happened.
That's great to hear.
Just going, yeah, I mean, I feel really fortunate that I found some things to do, because I have a lot of friends that are really kind of in a dark place.
Yeah.
From the lack of.
Yeah, I'm very curious as when this does end, God willing it does, like the amount of music and the kind of music that's. I think we're going to get a lot of different things from artists that we might not be used to, because they've been able to explore and also kind of be in a dark place. So I'm interested to see the vibe that's going to come. Yeah.
I think it's going to be exhilarating. I think it's when people are finally, live gigs are going to be better than they've ever been before.
Yep.
Oh yeah.
The creative juices, man. I sit there and I go through, watch YouTube and all kinds of stuff people are posting, and man, I'm like blown away by, you know, the creative process when people are hunkered down. Once you get past that initial shock of what you're going to have to be dealing with in terms of isolation. And all that. Some people are really doing some amazing stuff. And with the advent of, you know, a cappella and all these different formats for people doing remote recording together and stuff. It's like sitting here with you guys. I mean, you're not in the same studio together. You're
no.
totally different parts of the country. It's pretty,
it's amazing.
Pretty amazing.
We say it all the time. Like, before all this, Mike had moved away maybe 2 years ago or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Our podcast got better after he moved away somehow. We used to record in the same room, but I don't know, like scheduling got better. The technology got better, and it's just been, I don't know. It's pretty amazing to be able to still do that with no problem, like flawlessly.
Yeah. I think it's incredible. Yesterday? I spoke to a college music course at a university down in Alabama, and we sat and talked for over an hour with all the students and stuff. And I mean, to me, it's pretty amazing to have this ability to do these things. And,
all I know
so
is that
I wanted to embrace
the guy from Skype must be getting fired somehow. Like, I don't know how Zoom took over this space. Like Skype was able to do this well beforehand, but Zoom just like, I don't know. Like they just came in and became like the standard of talking to people over the internet. Like
easily.
Like people, we used to do our interviews on Skype and everyone had one. Now people are like, do you have Zoom? Like it's amazing.
Well, there's a couple other formats too.
A bunch.
Like if I'm going to do an interview and people say, here's what we've got. And I forget what the names are. And some of them are a total pain in the ass to log in on.
Yep.
And they say, well, you can't use Safari. You got to use Chrome and, you know, changing all this stuff around. And Zoom just feels like, it's so easy. I think with Skype, I think people thought of that more as like making phone calls.
I guess so.
It's like being and people still taking you seriously. And you go, oh, those are just cheap instruments.
Yeah.
You know, but they're really good, you know. But sometimes you got to dig yourself out of a perception. And I think Skype was never looked at in the way this works, even if it did work.
Yeah, a couple Zoom guys out of jobs
started. Like, it's cool.
Yeah, it's all in perspective. Now, people who've been in the business as long as you, like a lot of times, we'll find out like musicians, like bass players, they'll go to another band and play drums and that's it, or maybe try vocals. When I look up your information, the only other instrument than the piano that I've seen from you is listed as the guitarra mexicano. So out of curiosity, was there ever a thought process to branch out to like do other pieces, or were you just comfortable and say, I got my niche, I'm staying with the bass?
I think it was the latter. You know, I mean, I know guys that play like a half a dozen instruments and they do them all really great. And for me, I think I was lucky that when I started working, I was busy enough where I really just stayed focused on what I was doing, because I came into my career from college where I was an art and science major. I was thinking I was going to be a medical or a technical illustrator or something like that. And I really had no idea that I was going to be working as a bassist. And so when work started, work was intense immediately. And I really never looked back. It just stayed with the bass. And I probably would have ended up being a drummer otherwise, because I play air drums all the time when I'm listening to music.
The best. My steering wheel is like, there's like fingerprints at the top, at the, you know, oil slicks on the top of the steering wheel.
That's great. That's great.
You, so I guess you've probably been asked this question a lot, but I'm curious, you know, if you look you up, you're on thousands of albums, worked with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of artists. Is there one artist that like stands out to you, like as the most, I don't know, creative or something that really shocked you to work with, that like really changed your perspective on music from working with them, and you've kind of never seen it reproduced before?
Probably a lot of artists, because, you know, I mean, I was really lucky enough to be in on the ground floor with a lot of different artists in a lot of genres. And some of them really surprised me. I had low expectations, but my expectations weren't necessarily that high for what I was getting into. And I walked in and I found them to be like incredibly creative players and made really great records with them. Nothing totally, you know, blew my mind from the standpoint I walked in and I'd never heard anything like this before.
Yeah.
But it's been an interesting run for me. I think for me, the amount of genres that I've worked in,
it's awesome.
It's been interesting. So I've really kind of, you know, got to, you know, pull up my bootstraps every time I go to work, because generally I don't know what I'm going to. we don't get stuff in advance. We don't have any clue what we're going to be doing when we get to the studio. And sometimes you walk in and you're just kind of go, holy crap. You know, it's like, wow.
Cool.
Yeah. I mean, you had all the names that you said, you've also played bass for TV shows. And
yeah.
You performed with Dolly Parton both in a musical act and in one of her movies. So that's not something right there.
Just to hang with Dolly is worth the whole career. She's one of the greatest people I've ever known. So.
She's a gem.
Total joy. But, you know, like all the stuff we did with Phil Collins, I mean, I really, really proud of everything we did. And the tours were always amazing. And the adoration from the audience for that guy is pretty astounding.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I get to work with Lyle Lovett and people like that, it's a whole other animal. And man, I love playing with the large band. You get out there with 16 other musicians and it's a freight train that's going full steam ahead. It's pretty bitching.
That's awesome. So, what are you working on now, or where can people expect to maybe hear your work, and where's the best place for people to find you?
Well, work-wise, the thing I'm focused on right now is our band, The Immediate Family. And it's Danny Korchmar and Russ Kunkel and Waddy Wachtel and Steve Postel and myself. And I mean, we're finishing up another EP now. We had our album ready to go. It was supposed to be out in November. Huh. And needless to say, with the pandemic, everything's kind of ground to a halt.
Right.
But we have a lot of content on our Facebook page and on our YouTube channel. So people could go look up The Immediate Family. Yeah. Denny Tedesco, who did the Wrecking Crew movie, we're in the midst of doing a documentary film about our band with him.
Oh, nice.
And that'll probably be out late summer of next year, because that had to slow down too, because a lot of it is one-on-one interviews and stuff, and a lot of people are still hesitant about having film crew around them at this point.
Yeah.
You know, like anything, the most important thing right now is safety. It's just people staying safe.
Yeah.
So it's, so, but if they want to, check out the book, I had to create a website for the book, and it's called, and the website is LelandSklarsBeard.com.
That's awesome.
Somebody absconded my name, LelandSklar.com, and probably expected me to come and want to buy it from them, and, you know, screw that.
So yeah, right.
Leland Sklar's Beard, or they can go on YouTube. And I've got the channel, which I'm on every single day. And if I'm not kicked off of Facebook, I'm on Facebook and Twitter and all that crap.
Awesome.
Know? But I'm just enjoying working. You know, recording at home's been a real new adventure. I'm really enjoying that.
It's awesome, man. It's amazing that you're, you know, all these years, 50 plus years or whatever it is, making music, and you could still hear the passion coming through. As you're talking about it. So I'd love to hear that. I want to thank you so much for giving us a few minutes on the show. You're a really interesting guy. We'd love to have you on again down the line. And
anytime.
Awesome.
Anytime, you guys. I mean, I'm hanging here. You know, I'm around. So you know, awesome. If somebody cancels on you, call me.
I'm looking for a new co-host. So maybe the Leland and Scott show has a nice ring to it.
Hey, you never know. You never know. I don't know, you know, but you know, all this is good. I just can't wait to play again,
yeah.
You know, live. I mean, sure. Like everybody else, we're all just chomping at the bit. And I've been talking with, like we were talking about Victor Wooten, I've been talking with Vic and Steve Bailey about doing the camp.
Oh, yeah, thing. Yeah. He
I'll be glad when we can schedule that to do that, because, you know, that's such a beautiful thing that they put together, you know, every year for that.
Yeah, he told us a bunch of stories from that. Yeah, I'm dying to perform comedy one more time in front of a live audience again, too. These virtual shows are not cutting it, I'll tell you that much.
No.
Yeah, it's frustrating, but we have to survive this. And,
absolutely.
And the main thing is it's just not safe to go do anything yet. So,
right.
I mean, I just got my first shot 2 weeks ago, and I'm scheduled for my second shot on the 25th. Because being an old fart, I got into the age group thing. You know?
Good for you.
Good for you. Final question from me. Yeah. I found this quote interesting. You once said, I've been on the road for 42 years and I've only broken two strings and I play really hard. Out of curiosity, do you remember the two incidents in question?
I remember one of them very well. And it was probably around 1971. And when we were out with James Taylor, it was guerrilla touring in those days, man. Nobody knew what the hell they were doing. I mean, we had like road guys were mixing the show kind of thing.
And, yeah.
And I ended up breaking, my D string on my old jazz bass. For some reason, you know, I couldn't afford strings or anything like that at that point. And for some reason, this string broke in the middle of a show. And I told the, guy who was our kind of road manager, but he was also like mixing the monitors. I yelled at him. I said, go get me a D string. But he didn't know what he was doing. So he comes back and hands me a string, and I'm winding it on, and James is telling a story, trying to get through it. He gave me an A string.
Right.
And man, I am cranking this A. I thought I was going to snap the neck off my bass. And when I tried to play it, man, that thing would not move. The tension was like unbelievable.
Yeah.
So I'll never forget that one, man. It was like just one of those moments where you're just, you know, your life's passing before your eyes because there's an audience, you know, waiting to hear another song, and you're up there just struggling away.
I remember so one of
James
my...
James Taylor's up there ad-libbing and all.
Oh, yeah.
Where are you from?
Well, that's... Thank God I was with an audience at that point, because James was great at that. So he would tell jokes and... You know, and I'm over there just cranking away on this goddamn string.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it was funny. But I've been really lucky. I mean, I do play really pretty hard. I'm an aggressive player when I have to be live. And I've been lucky. I've never really had a problem breaking strings where some people do it.
It's funny you say that. Real quick, I remember one of my first bands in high school, and this was a place like you had to – get 25 people to come see you, and they give you like $1 a ticket or whatever the hell it was. We got all these people from school to come, and I go to play, and the input on my bass just craps out. So I literally have to spend, and I only had one bass. It was barely, you know, it was a two. I had to spend the entire show singing backup, but no bass. We played like four songs. I walked off miserably. I like, as you were saying that, like the hairs on my arms were standing up. It was so embarrassing, you know?
It's when those things happen, those are the memories that you have. I mean, you could have a stellar career and it's like, those are the things that, that immediately jump to the front of your head.
Yep. It's like bombing stories in comedy. There's nothing better.
Do you have a moment for another crazy story?
Yeah, quickly. Yep.
Okay. Yeah. In 1966, I played a senior prom for a high school. I had graduated high school in 65, and that's when I stopped shaving and getting a haircut. And Dan Dugmore was in the band, who is like such a great player and played with James and stuff. We were going to play this senior prom and at this high school. And when the principal walked in, he took one look at the stage and saw me up there. And he said, "There's no way that hippie's going to be on our stage." And we're sitting there going, "Jesus, there's a whole bunch of kids are ready to come in and have their senior prom." And we're all, so I ended up having to play the show standing behind a curtain.
Oh,
at
Jesus.
The back of the
stage. No.
My amp was on the stage. But my cord ran out and ran behind the curtain. And so I was like the mystery man.
That's hysterical.
I remember that gig like it was yesterday. You know?
I picture like the curtain and your beard just kind of blowing on the side of it. Like, tuck it behind.
All I needed was a little dog to come and pull the curtain away. You know, and ignore the man behind the curtain.
Leland, this has been a great time. Please stay safe out there, and we hope to have you on again.
You too, my friends. You guys stay safe, man. That's the most important thing right now, and I wish you all the very best.
Leland Sklar, Mike. Now you're growing your hair. Your hair is like amazingly long. Like you're getting, you're almost down to the shoulders.
It's pretty close.
Yeah.
There. No, I got like the reverse. I can't do the chin beard, so I'm doing the head beard.
I was just gonna say. Any thought to just growing the full beard out next?
I have tried and tried and tried. I just get patches in here and in there. Like my dad, like he had a. He didn't have a long beard, but he had a good full beard for a while. And he pretty much said it took him into his 40s just to kind of start it.
Okay.
And I just keep on getting the patches. But apparently, for what my family says, like we got part Cherokee in the family. And there's a thing in the family where they say, well, you probably got the Cherokee blood where you can't grow a beard, which is kind of interesting, where I almost want to Google if there's like a Cherokee chief who had a beard, if that's like an actual scientific fact or not.
Mike can grow a beard. No, I was hoping like maybe we're seeing like the evolution. So when we're doing the podcast, like, you know, 3 years from now, you're looking like Leland's rocking that beard. I mean, his beard is epic. I was calculating that I have not been facial hairless without facial hair since 2002.
So it's been a while.
Yeah. And I get anxiety about like cutting it. Alex is always like, "Oh, give it a shot." I'm like, "I can't do it. I can't do it. I don't know what it is." So I'm sure Leland understands. I mean, he probably understands more than anybody, but
has there ever been a time where you in that 18 years where like maybe I'll switch, you know, minus Alex, but like somewhere you said naturally, maybe I'll cut it off.
I still get thoughts like every once in a while, like what do we, like it'd be fun to like shave it all off and surprise the wife and you know, but then I'm like, nah, like I don't know. I just don't know what it is. And it's funny because like, you know, how things go in trends where like over the last, I mean, maybe it's kind of fading out now, but like maybe the last 5 years or so, like beards have been really like big. Like a lot of people have beards, a lot of like celebrities and whatnot. And I'm always like, oh man, I don't want people to think I have this because, you know, it's pop. I don't know. It's just like part of me. It's like, I've had beard and flannel. I've been wearing stupid flannel since fifth grade. and like this dumb beard since like I didn't have the full beard probably like 2007 or so, but I had like a goatee and whatever. But like it's not for any particular reason. I can't even explain it completely either. So I don't know.
It's the mental scare of if this looks bad, there's not really a quick turnaround. You can't click the undo button.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember like back then it took me a long time to grow it. So now I'm like, what if I shave it off? It takes me a long time to grow. I don't know. I'm sure there's something called like beard anxiety that people who have it for so long, like my uncle was like that. He had a beard his whole life. And I remember the few times he shaved it, he's like, ugh, ugh. And he was like in a nursing home and they'd be like, oh, we want to shave. You want to shave? And be like, no, not like he can barely even talk. He was like a stroke victim. He had a stroke and lost his ability to speak, and he would still be like, like, you know, he never is. I don't know what it is. I'm going to look up beard anxiety and see if that's that's a thing. But
so basically your uncle had one good arm and he used it just to stroke his beard is what you're telling.
Correct. Correct. But
now if you ever chose to cut it, would you go full clean cut, or would you do something like maybe take the side?
I'd take it down probably first. I'd probably take it way down first and let it and see if that's doable. And then if not, I'd go all the way. I don't think I could ever do mustache alone unless it was for like a joke or, you know, like an event or something. If there was like a charity event or something and then shave your beard, I could do a good cause for it. Maybe I'd think about it. But just to do it, I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. I don't know. Although if my son keeps pulling on it the way he is, it might happen sooner or later because it hurts, man. And he's only like 3.5 months old. So, but he's like pulling it like those fakes, you know, kids who think Santa's fake. But Leland Sklar, everybody. Yeah. So, Berla, what do you got before we go?
Well, Scott, have you heard about a Gorilla Glue lady?
I have. Glued her hair on with Gorilla Glue. Not a bad move.
Yeah, so for the people who don't know, there was a person on TikTok, I believe. She does different tutorials or whatever. And she basically informed everybody that the reason why her hair was the same for the last month was because she ran out of hairspray, and she thought the best thing to do as a substitute was use Gorilla Glue. Now, Gorilla Glue is not meant for the human body.
No.
It basically turned into cement.
Mm-hmm.
She washed her hair hundreds of times with no results. She had to go into the ER just to get her ponytail cut off. And from what I understand, she flew out to Beverly Hills. A doctor there was very nice to kind of do a procedure to kind of get her hair loose, because the regular thing to get Gorilla Glue off is acetone, which very much burns the scalp. So
yeah.
They, after that first attempt, they had to go to a different route there. So she's
arguably, though, it might be the best move in her career because she has everybody talking about her.
Well, here's my like right off the bat. I don't know why Gorilla Glue is not going out there saying, see how good we are?
Yeah.
Like, she tried everything to break up Gorilla Glue.
Yeah.
And nothing would happen. But I guess they're distancing themselves because as she is lawyering.
Because here's what will happen. Before you know it, there's going to be kids on TikTok doing the Gorilla Glue challenge and being like, I taped this to my head. How long can it last? Like, it's going to be this viral thing, and they're going to be like the name behind it.
Yeah, and then on top of it, she's getting a lawyer because their claim is, well, the can says don't use on your skin, in your eyes, or I forget what was the third one, maybe your mouth, but it says nothing about hair.
Maybe when you get that final haircut, you should cut your hair off and then glue it back on for the show. Good content right there.
Yeah. You were talking about you're scared to shave your beard. It's just like, no, this don't look good. Just start grabbing patches, like Gorilla gluing it on there.
Yeah, that'd be a good test. Can I Gorilla Glue my beard back and see if anyone notices during the day?
So based off of that story, Scott, I have a little game of Would You Rather.
Okay.
Where basically in all these synopses, you're going to be stuck with whatever I tell you for a month.
The scenarios, you mean?
What's up?
Scenarios, you mean?
Yeah, so I'm going to give you two items. You would say, which would you rather have glue or stuck to you where everybody sees it on you for like a month?
Okay.
And from there, we'll take that winner and go to the next item and see what you end up getting stuck to yourself for a month.
Let's rock and roll.
Okay. So we're going to start with what she basically had. I kind of changed. I said the worst hairdo you ever had. Do you kind of recall what your worst hairdo was?
I do. I could probably find a picture and post it along with this. I had like this very long, like when I wash my hair gets very like Afro-y. So I like, I have to do like a wash like every 2 to 3 days. Otherwise I'm just sporting a big poof kind of. And I grew my hair out, like I was playing in a band and had my hair long. And there's this picture of me where it just looks like I have this like cube like mullet on my head.
Oh, wow.
And it's really the picture. Like it was more of like I parted in the middle and it was long. But like when it got poofy, it just looked kind of like a hair helmet.
Yeah, for me, it's either between I had a phase where I had a flat top.
Ooh.
Or, yeah, it just when it was in the phase and all didn't really work out. Or it could be the time when the family didn't have a lot of money, so they tried to save money by cutting. My mom would cut my hair, and she kind of oopsied on the top, so I kind of went a Friar Tuck for a little bit.
Nice. Any chance you can do one of those for the show when this haircut coming up?
Send a can of Gorilla Glue. We're talking over. So, Scott, your choices are stuck with your worst hairdo or stuck with sunglasses on your face. And that's all the time for 1 month.
I'm going to go with my worst haircut. At least, like, I'm not going indoors and being like, I can't see anything. You know, I like sunglasses. I wear them, you know, outside. But sunglasses inside, that's a terrible look. At least my haircut. You know, I'm a big hat guy. Like, I'll basically always have a hat on. So I can cover that up until the hair grows back.
Well, keep in mind, though, we're talking Gorilla Glue law, so that's going to be like cement. So it's just going to be like hovering on top of your bad hair.
It's still cover. It's still some cover. Whereas sunglasses, okay. What am I going to do? Wear a burka? I can't do much.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So worst hairdo you ever had or rollerblades?
Oh, dude.
Everywhere you go for a month, you're wearing rollerblades.
I'm going to do the rollerblade challenge because one, feel like it's a great way to like really burn some calories, man. Like rollerblading around. Like I also am pretty mad that rollerblades went out of style. I was a huge rollerblader when I was young, hockey in the street all the time. I was one of the kids and we made ramps. I remember we made ramps behind Krausers. We would take the pallets that they shipped in and make ramps all day long. I remember hurting myself many a time trying to grind, you know. I loved rollerblading. I once bet my ex-girlfriend that I could rollerblade to work. And work was like, I don't want to like oversell it or undersell, but I'm going to say work was probably 6 to 7 miles away. And okay. I was like, yeah, I could do that. And I worked at a pool at the time. And now rollerblades are great until you get to a hill and you're just like pushing and kind of sliding down the hill. And I forgot that like where we work at the end was at the top of like this hill. So I like was dying, got up the hill. I went from the top of the hill and like the pool we worked at, there was barely any people there. I rollerbladed all the way down, said hi to people and literally rollerbladed into the pool just because I was so hot. This was also mid-July because it was a summer pool. But I'm down with bringing rollerblades back. Get rid of that hair. I feel like I'd be my calves and my thighs would be ripped after a month of rollerblades. I'd be jacked.
You'd be jacked, but you're going to get some looks while you're rollerblading through like Acme and going to the bank and
it's
stuff.
It's 2020,
like that.
Bro. 20. I identify as a rollerblader. You know, it's okay. Whatever it is, whatever.
It's your choice. Okay, stuck with rollerblades, rollerblades. Or stuck with your mouth open to show everybody off your teeth.
Oh, this is so easy for me. I'm like self-conscious of my teeth from having 3,000 teeth injuries. And I don't love my teeth to begin with. Fortunately, I have a mouth that doesn't show my teeth that much. It took me, we talked about this on the podcast. It took me years to go back to the dentist and get some stuff done. I'm rollerblading right past the dentist on this one. right past the teeth option. I'm staying in those blades for another month.
Okay. Roller blades or a fez?
I mean, if I was living in, like, Brooklyn, I feel like the fez, no one would even say a word to me if I was wearing a fez for a month. Like, yeah. You know, like, they'd just be like,
it
oh.
It depends on the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Sure, like, if you were in San Fran, it probably would be like, why aren't you wearing a fez for a month?
Yeah, like, no one would bat an eye. You know, around where I live, I'd get some interesting looks. The legs could use a break, possibly, from the blades. But I'm going to stick to my childhood roots here, Mike. I've never worn a fez. I don't think I'm going to start wearing one. I'm going to stick with the rollerblades. It still sleeping in rollerblades sounds terrible. I'm not going to lie. Also, taking care of a baby in rollerblades sounds awful. Like, oh, let me get you a bottle. Whoosh, whoosh, you know, like. But,
well, it'd be kind of sweet while you're holding the baby and you go down the stairs getting like some sweet air coming down to like the living room.
Yeah. Imagine those photos, like those old skate magazines, like the stills in the air, like me holding a baby with like holding one blade. Pretty cool photo.
Oh, yeah. You'd be the popular dad.
Sticking with blades. Okay. Sticking with blades.
Roller blades or a Christmas sweater? And we're talking Christmas sweater now, February. It's comfortable, but people are going to kind of...
I feel like with the advent of the ugly sweater party, it's not even become a thing anymore. Like remember when you saw a Christmas sweater maybe 10 years ago? You're like, oh, man, that's terrible. But you see a Christmas sweater now, you're kind of like, oh, all right. Ugly sweaters are kind of fun. Like, everyone wears ugly sweaters. So I feel like... For the least impact on my life, like I don't want to be the rollerblade guy at the food store. I don't want to be the rollerblade guy at the hardware store. Just a guy in a Christmas sweater. Maybe I could pull it off as just a winter sweater in February. I'm gonna just go with a nice little Christmas sweater. I think nowadays no one would bat an eye.
Interesting. I like your thinking here. Okay, Christmas sweater or a plastic nose. Kind of like Static G from Digital Underground.
I think this is an easy one. I mean, plastic nose is terrible, man.
Not bringing back the Humpty Hump? Come on now.
Uncomfortable, really obvious. Definitely going to get some police calls on me, a guy in a plastic nose. Plus, nowadays with the mask and plastic nose, that's a lot. Christmas sweater, pretty easy, man. It's just a sweater.
Think about it. Now you can be one of those people who don't have to put it over your nose. You're like, I got a covering. I can just cover the mouth.
Yeah. But I'm still going to go with the Christmas sweater. Pretty easy one.
Okay. Christmas sweater or an iPod stuck on replay on the worst song that your wife loves.
Yeah,
so your wife's going to be happy, but you might be a little agitated come a month from now.
There'd definitely be some like Taylor Swift type stuff playing in my ear over and over again. To me, again, it, like even my favorite music, I don't want to hear for 30 days straight. You know, I don't want to get sick of the things I love. So to me, just a nice, comfortable Christmas sweater in February is okay. Now, if we were doing this, if we were doing this in July... Could be a totally different argument, but
if you recall from the Shenanigans Showdown, I challenged you to go down the shore in July with a Christmas sweater on, and you almost did.
That's true.
You couldn't find one.
Yep.
Okay, Christmas sweater or a jersey of your favorite team of the worst player you ever signed.
Funny you say that. I think I own a jersey of the worst player the Mets have ever signed. I didn't buy this, so you can't yell at me. But I got this as a wedding gift. And I was in someone's wedding, and they bought me a Jason Bay New York Mets jersey, and I have
that
was it.
The name you're gonna bring up.
I have it somewhere in the closet. I might have, and it's cool because it was like the I don't know if the one year they kind of did like an off-white one, like a cream, like it almost looked like a dirty white. And it was a really nice jersey, and I would wear it. It was the pinstripes and everything, but it has number 44. Jason Bay on it. I think I gotta go. I think I gotta stick with the Christmas sweater. I don't want to wear Jason Bay every second. Someone going, Jason Bay, like, you know, with the Red Sox, he hit 40 home runs. The Mets, he hit like four, you know. So, no, definitely not wearing that. It's funny because I own this thing. I literally own the thing that you just asked me.
Christmas sweater or angel wings?
I mean, again, I think I think Christmas sweater's not that bad. Angel wings, again, I'm getting like possible police calls on me. Like, there's a freaking dude in angel wings holding guacamole in the Acme line waiting to check out. Like, Christmas sweater.
In rollerblades while wearing a plastic nose.
Yeah, and a fez. To me, Christmas sweater, I don't think I'm getting that many weird looks right now. I'm getting like, really, dude? But I'm not getting like, what the hell is the angel-winged man doing in my store? So Christmas sweater it is.
Okay. Christmas sweater or kiss the cook apron? Everywhere you go, it says kiss the cook.
I mean, like, for the fun of the game, I would say, I'd wear the apron. It's not as hot. I'm not really a sweater guy. Mm-hmm. But for the general looks in public, I got to say Christmas sweater again. I feel like I'm being boring choosing that, but I got to be honest during the game too. So kiss the cook. Again, who is this guy let out of the Elon, the place I talked about before in that documentary where wearing this thing in the store or going to see my parents like, hey, guys, and I'm just wearing that? That's terrible. Yeah.
Were you cooking, Scotty? Nope. Just threw it on.
Yeah, just it's comfortable. It's comfortable.
Yeah. I look at the wife. I'm like, hey, baby, what does it read? All right. Christmas sweater or glued to a person you like but has nothing but really boring stories and are told all the time.
I mean, do I even have to answer this one?
Technically, you do.
I couldn't be glued to anyone, dude. I don't like being touched that much. I'm not a big, like I'm a guy who can never really go to a... I don't think I could ever go get a pedicure. I don't like my feet touched. I don't like people being too close. One time my dad, like, squeezed my nose so hard on an Easter that he left black and blue on my nose, and, like, I was devastated from that. I hate people touching my face. It's like, being glued to... Going to the bathroom, that's the worst one. That should be how it started, because that would be... That's the hardest one. I'd rather be in all the other things at once then be glued to somebody.
All right. Well, that's our list, Scott. So we'll send you some adhesive glue and something with Rudolph on it. And you get to enjoy your February like this.
It's not bad. It's not bad. Well, I mean, I feel like you celebrate Christmas all year long. So why can't I?
Now, to be fair, the tree came down 2 weeks ago.
So. Oh, wow. That might be a record.
Could be. I'm trying to think.
Oh, man. Another great episode tonight. I want to thank Leland Sklar. What a wealth of musical information and just a really cool guy. So please go check out his YouTube content. He's a pleasure to have him on. Berlew, anything to promote before we skedaddle?
I will promote one of my favorite breweries, Halfway Crooks. As I brought up before, I try to go there once every 2 weeks. Some great traditional German beers, some great smoke beers. They currently have the Slow Jams beer, which I told Scott about, which is the can that looks like NBA Jam. That's a 7% Baltic style porter. Everything I've got there is delicious. Delicious food. Right in the middle of the city by Georgia State Stadium. Check them out. Halfway Crooks Brewery.
All right. I'm going to promote an old professor of mine in college. I actually helped work on her documentary film back in the day. I did some video work for her, and she did a documentary on her partner. Grew up in Afghanistan, and it was all about the bombings and things like that and leaving Afghanistan. But anyway, that was a whole other story. But her partner, they have a YouTube channel called Earthly Delights Thrifts, like thrift items. And what they do is they do different videos about getting thrift items and how to resell. They sell a ton of things on eBay. They're like kind of like professional eBay sellers, if you will. They just put out a video, 15 Bolo flips for resellers. And they put out a lot of good content, and she's done some amazing stuff. She's a professor at Ramapo College for TV and video. So go check out Earthly Delights Thrifts. That's it, guys. We have some really cool content coming out in the next few weeks. So if you enjoyed tonight, please stick with us because there's some more coming down the line. We are booked well into March, into April, with all sorts of cool guests coming on. So other than that, please listen to the podcast, like us, share us, leave a review. That really helps. And that's it, guys. Life is funny. Laugh at it and keep the wind at your back.
And coming soon, opening up the Verbal Shenanigans Child Discipline Facility down here in Douglasville, Georgia. Check us out.
Never cared, and that she never